The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
And he would say, have you the confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow? People actually gave him their watches, and that's how Confidence Man was born.
What makes a good con artist? Why are we more likely to be tricked when we're emotionally vulnerable? In The Confidence Game, author Maria Konnikova surveys con artists from all different walks of life, from global swindlers to small-time street hustlers. Delving into traits of narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism, she suggests how some of the skills of the con artist might be redeployed for the greater good. Maria, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we start by talking about what we mean by a con artist, Maria?
Absolutely. Well, I was very surprised actually to find when I started researching this that con stands for confidence game. And it's a term that's been around at least from the 1800s. And there was a gentleman who would come up to people on the streets of New York and he would ask them, he was always very dapper, very well-dressed, quite nice looking, and he would say, have you the confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow? And this seems quite bizarre, but people actually gave him their watches because this was something that kind of impinged on their sense of respectability. You know, what kind of a person are you? Are you the type of person who will trust me, who believes about, you know, the good in people, a good world? And that's how Confidence Man was born. And it's someone who takes advantage of your confidence in them, your trust for their own purposes. And so you give them your confidence. They don't take it from you. You do so willingly, and you end up becoming, I hate the word complicit because it makes it seem like you deserve it, but you do give them the trust. They don't steal it. They don't do anything outright criminal at that particular stage of the game. That's what we mean when we're talking about who the con artist is, what he does, what the con actually is.
In the book, you introduce some pretty astonishing characters. One of the most famous cases you talk about is that of Ferdinand Waldo Demara. Why was he so fascinating?
Well, Demara was someone who operated for decades. He kept getting caught and he kept doing it over and over again, and not in small ways. He would really con people in these absolutely huge, just all out ways that were incredibly successful, no matter how famous he got. So the story that opens my book was one of the ones that really captured my attention. It happened during the Korean War, and Demara stole the credentials of a doctor, and he applied to the Navy to be a surgeon. And he really did his homework because the Canadian Royal Navy was woefully short on doctors at the time. And so he knew that they would actually be a pretty good target, which is just a caveat. You can profile institutions the same way that you can profile individual victims. So then he applies, he gets an appointment right away, and he ends up sailing out aboard this huge ship with hundreds of soldiers' lives under his care because, of course, he's the only doctor aboard. So then they get to North Korea, they're out at sea, and all of a sudden they see a small boat which has wounded soldiers because it's the middle of the war. And instead of running away or saying, you know, these are Koreans, I don't actually have to operate, Demara starts cutting them open. He starts operating on them. This guy has not finished high school, and yet he has the gall to play God, to play doctor, and to actually play with life and death. And the very surprising thing is he doesn't kill anyone, at least on the operating table. We don't know what happens to the soldiers after they all leave to go back to North Korea, so presumably some of them might not have survived. But as far as we know, they all survive. Dispatches cover Canada. This is such a great story. So amazing doctor performing surgery on the high seas. The real Dr. Sear, who's the man whose credentials he stole, ends up hearing of this. Demara is unmasked. The Navy does not press charges because their reputation is so thoroughly embarrassed, and instead they just ask him to hush it and to not talk about it and to leave quietly. And of course, Damar is only too thrilled to do that because it allows him to then go back to the United States, where he promptly re-enlists in the Navy under a different name. And so the story continues, and he keeps getting caught, and he keeps going on to do these crazy, crazy things. He becomes a prison warden in Texas. He founds a religious college. I mean, the list is endless. He even cons his own biographer, steals his identity, and his biographer still believes in him.
Conning people into thinking that you're a ship's doctor sounds pretty drastic. I mean, why do people do this? It doesn't sound like it's a, you know, pack of laughs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's actually an incredibly important question, because people assume that con artists do it for the money, that they're greedy. And I actually don't think that's true. I think even the ones who are greedy and do make money, there's a deeper motivation there, because a lot of them are incredibly intelligent people who would have been very successful in legitimate professions and sometimes would have made even more money. But I think that there's something there about power, about this rush that they get out of knowing that they have power over other people, that they control and manipulate other people's lives, that they know something that you don't, that they can pull one over on you. I think, you know, it's something not unlike addiction, where you get that rush and that thrill from just the sheer joy and the sheer power of being able to do that. And I think that's why a lot of them can't stop, even when they have the financial means to do so, and even when they have legitimate opportunities. It's very, very rare to see someone go straight, so to speak, because I think they miss it too much. They really just enjoy what they do.
So, Maria, what are the key traits of a con artist? Are there particular things that we look for?
I think that we need to be very careful to not assign one profile to every con artist and say, okay, this is a con artist, because we do know that con artists are different, and that there's nothing that will make it absolutely certain that you will become a con artist. As I read in the book, and this is, I think, a statement that a lot of scientists make, that there's a thing that, like genes, and they load the gun, but it's the environment that pulls the trigger. And even in the case of con artists, there aren't even genes necessarily. I do write about something that a lot of con artists, not all, but a lot of them have, and that's some or all of the so-called dark triad of traits, which is psychopathy. And I think we all know what psychopathy is. It's a lack of empathy. You don't experience emotion the way that other people do. It's something that really allows con artists to do what they do and to not feel empathy for the victims, which is absolutely crucial. There's one con artist that I quote who says, you know, the moment that you feel any sort of sympathy, you're dead in the water. And I think that's very accurate. So that's the first part of it. The second part is narcissism. When we think of narcissism, we think ego. And it's not just ego. It's also entitlement. It's the sense that I deserve it. So Damara, for instance, he thought that he was smarter than doctors. He thought he was a better physician. He thought he was smarter than the PhDs. So he decided to just take the credentials. Why in the world would he even need to finish high school if he was already smarter than everyone? I deserve it. I'm better. So let me just steal these and keep going. So it's something that really lets you feel like you deserve exactly what you're doing. And then the final part of it is Machiavellianism, which comes from Machiavelli's The Prince. And this is the ability to persuade others, to kind of manipulate them subtly so that they do what you want them to do, but they don't know it. They think they're doing exactly what they want to do. And I think that's actually something that almost all con artists need to have, because that's kind of the skill that lets them deceive without seeming deceitful.
It seems that at the heart of every con is a good yarn. You know, the con artist has to sort of spin some convincing tale. What makes a convincing con story? Have there been studies into that side of things?
Well, we do know what makes a convincing story. And I think con artists at their heart, that's exactly what they are. They're consummate storytellers. That's their profession. They're incredibly good at figuring out, you know, just what to say and how to say it. So we know that convincing stories do a few things really well. The most important thing that they do is they engage you emotionally. you start feeling like you're part of the story. You're transported. There's actually something called the transportation scale that people who study this use that measures how involved and engrossed you are in the narrative. So you're transported into this other world, and you start really empathizing and identifying with that world. And when that happens, when you're emotionally engaged, when you're transported, you stop thinking logically, you stop thinking rationally, and you don't even realize you're doing it. You still think you're logical and rational, but suddenly you're not seeing red flags. To you, they're not red flags. You stop seeing inconsistencies because you start, you know, you're telling yourself the story as much as the story is being told to you. So that is something that they can do remarkably well. And sometimes these can be very emotionally draining stories, so something very negative. There's one con artist I write about who pretended to be the victim of sex trafficking, and she did this in 3 countries, including Ireland, where she had the government spending hundreds of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to find out who she was and help her, and she was a con artist. But sometimes they can be really positive. They don't actually have to be negative. So it can be just a fascinating tale of a pirate, for instance. There's the Sir Francis Drake fortune, which was presumably tied up in the English legal system. Sir Francis Drake had an illegitimate heir with Queen Elizabeth. This was the story, and people bought it. But that's a really emotionally involving story for a very different reason, because it's so exciting. You know, everyone loves pirates and kind of these tales of adventure. So it can go in any direction, but at its heart, it's the same thing. It's a story that will get you emotionally transported enough that you stop asking questions, or at least the questions that matter.
And in terms of the research that's going on at the moment into sort of the psychology of con artistry, what's the current state of play? What's happening at the moment? What are the big questions that are puzzling the scientific community about these fantastic storytellers, as you call them?
Well, I think people are trying to figure out, you know, first, one of the things that we talked about, what motivates them to do this. Second, how are they able to do this? And third, is there anything that unites people who believe them? So people have tried, you know, they try to see, okay, what are they actually doing? Are there tools of persuasion that they're using? Are there certain things that we can use to identify that this is actually happening? And so people are doing research into the particular modes of persuasion. So this goes back to Robert Cialdini's work on influence. They actually look, okay, can we analyze these transcripts? Can we look at what's happening when cons and frauds are in progress and see, you know, how are they actually approaching it? And they do see a lot of interesting patterns. The problem is there are lots of different patterns, and it can be really difficult to train a person to identify them. There's really interesting work happening on the technology end where they're trying to train algorithms to do this, and they end up performing often a lot better than people at detecting these sorts of things. But one of the places where we really come short, and scientists have been trying to figure out a way to circumvent this, and they have not been successful, is detecting lying. Humans are incredibly bad at detecting lying. Technology is incredibly bad at detecting lying. Psychologists and neuroscientists, actually, everyone is trying to figure out, you know, is there a signature to lying? Can we look at the brain? Can we look at physiological signals? Can we look at this? Can we look at that? And unfortunately, no matter how much they look, everything just comes up woefully short. It's really hard to detect deception.
So Maria, one of the things you mentioned there is that scientists are trying to work out, you know, how people lie and how people are deceived. Can you talk me through a few of the studies you've come across?
Sure. Well, one of the things that's been happening for a long time are people like Paul Ekman who actually try to see, are there any signs that people give off of lying? And Ekman's become known for his work on microexpressions. The idea behind that is that we have leakage, cognitive leakage. So when you're lying, you're stressed, there are things going on, and so inevitably you'll have this microexpression, which is just milliseconds long, that will show that you have a different emotion from the one that you're expressing. And there are some people, kind of his super lie detectors, who can actually see those micro expressions and detect lying, or so we think that way. The only problem with that is that people who lie as who they are, they don't experience leakage, and you can't actually see that. So I interviewed one of Ekman's original participants, one of the people who was his super lie detector, and she told me that, you know, in the criminal world, in people who are psychopaths and people who do this for a living, she meets her match. There's nothing to see. And that really scares her, because for normal people, she can easily see microexpressions, but here she can't. There's no way you can train yourself to spot something that doesn't exist, because there is no leakage. You know, for them, this is who they are. They're not lying, they're being themselves. So I think that's one area where we have to be really hesitant to say, you know, oh, there's a microexpression, or there's some other sort of Pinocchio's nose that will tell you when someone's lying. We don't have any good evidence that that actually exists. And one of the areas that's now receiving the most coverage and the most hype is fMRI. Can we look at the brain? Does the brain lie, or does the brain tell the truth? And unfortunately, we have no good evidence right now that fMRIs are going to ever be as successful as we need them to. And I think this gets down to a very fundamental problem, which is, what is a lie? If the person doesn't believe that he's lying, or kind of for him this is not a lie, then what in the world is your brain going to show you?
You're careful to point out that, you know, we can all of us be conned. I mean, this isn't something which is only happens to a certain group of people, but what makes us more susceptible?
One of the things that makes us more susceptible is not who we are, but rather where we happen to find ourselves in life. What I mean by that is, people experience life changes, and some of those life changes can be more disturbing than others. And I don't mean disturbing in a negative way. I mean disturbing literally in the sense of disturbing where you are, of change and fluctuation. And what we find is that a lot of victims are in a very emotionally vulnerable point in their lives. So a lot of them, you know, they've gone through some sort of drastic event, and it could be negative. For instance, you know, divorce or death or job loss or anything like that. But it can also be positive. It can be a new job. It can be a move across a country. It can be a wedding. Something that just really changes your frame of reference. Because one of the things that we really dislike is this feeling of uncertainty. Humans really are averse to that, and averse to ambiguity. We like things to be more clear-cut. And so what ends up happening is, con artists will take advantage of that. They will give us meaning, they will give us certainty, they will give us stability when we're most looking for it, even though we might not even realize we're looking for it. They see those openings, and that's when you become a much more attractive target.
It seems, as you were saying earlier, that some of the cases that you cover in your book, it seems that the con artists themselves are almost deceiving themselves. There's some rather tragic cases. You mentioned the one of the young girl. Why is it that someone would be driven to pursue that kind of con?
It's a really interesting question. And the funny thing is, well, funny is a terrible word to use. The strange thing is, someone like Samantha Azzopardi, who's the girl who pretends to be a victim of sex trafficking, and I'm, by the way, using the present tense on purpose because I don't think we've seen the last of her. It seems like she's very emotionally disturbed, and yet she gets a clean mental bill of health every time she's evaluated. She comes from a fine family. I think, once again, it's the same thing that we've talked about with people like Damara in a perverse way. They get a rush out of the attention and out of the power. I mean, can you imagine the sense of power, knowing that you have an entire country's law enforcement working on your behalf? You're the center of everyone's attention, not just a few people, but they're just spending so much time, so much energy, so much money on you and on your story. I mean, I can only imagine that to someone who loves that kind of a rush, that would be pretty incredible.
You've said before that there are some cases where you almost admire the con artists and their skills because they're just so deft at pulling off these stunts. Why do we find these people and their stories sort of just so fascinating? Why are we so captivated by a story of a good con artist, as it were?
I think that we find those stories so captivating because, I mean, in a way, we can all look at them as kind of heroic almost figures, in the sense that we glamorize a lot of criminals. And the criminals who are easiest to glamorize are the ones who, one, we can't see ourselves being the victim, and two, they're not actually, you know, committing violent murders or doing anything that egregious, because I think everyone convinces themselves that, oh, well, you can't fool an honest man, and victims are greedy, and it could never happen to me. And so then, just a cool story of someone who's actually quite clever. A lot of them don't commit crimes, which is kind of amazing, that there's nothing that you can actually point to that say, oh, they didn't steal money, they didn't steal this, they didn't steal that. Samantha, as a party, has never served any jail time. Even in Ireland, after she did this, she wasn't convicted of anything, because what are you going to do? We admire that ability to really outwit other people, and that admiration comes with a dose of skepticism that we would ever be victims, and so we feel removed enough from it.
That's an interesting point, because it brings me on to my next question, which is that in the book you say that gullibility may be deeply ingrained in the human behavioral repertoire. Does that mean that we all have an innate susceptibility to being conned? Is there just, you know, none of us are foolproof, is what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. We're hardwired to trust other people, because what ends up happening is that trust ends up being evolutionarily adaptive, because in order for society to develop, you have to trust one another. You can't think that everyone is out to get you. So when you look at the data, you see that societies with higher levels of trust end up being more successfully economically. They end up having better institutions, better social networks, and societies with lower level of trust, the opposite is the case. They have problems with economic and social development. They have all sorts of institutional problems as well. On a personal level, we find that people who are higher in generalized trust end up being smarter, happier, healthier. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because that is not just how societies develop, how institutions are built, but that's also how we become protected against negative stressors. One of the things we know about human psychology is that one of the single most protective factors that will have you live longer, be healthier, and have all sorts of positive outcomes is the strength of your social connections and your social networks. And how in the world do you build those connections and networks if you don't trust? So I think that trust plays an essential part of our lives, and because of that, we will always be susceptible to cons.
Interesting that you bring up the phrase social network there, because I was about to ask, when it comes to things like social media, we now share so much more of our personal information. It's easy to tell from someone's Twitter profile or whatever, you know, what they're interested in and so on and so forth.
Absolutely.
How does that feed into the work of a con artist? And have you seen any changes in the number of cons that are going on? I'd be interested to know if they're on the rise with the rise of social media or not.
Well, social media definitely makes the con artist's job much, much simpler, because we just leave so much information out there. It becomes so easy to profile us. You know, we're leaving our likes, our interests, our friends, where we go, what kind of food we like, what our Amazon wish list is, you know, the kinds of things we're hoping to buy or to receive. Did we get married? Or are we expecting a baby? Or is something else happening? All of these things are online, and you don't have to be a hacker. You don't even have to be particularly technologically savvy to get this sort of information. So yes, we do see a rise in technology fraud every single year. I think what it's done is lower the bar to entry, so it becomes much easier to be a good con artist. Whereas before, you know, you really had to do your legwork. Now, you can just sit in front of your computer and let the victims come to you. And in fact, I actually interviewed someone who is now a neuroscientist but used to be a hacker, a white hat hacker. And he talked about how his team, he recently spoke with them, and they've said that their job has become so much easier than it was 20 years ago when he was involved in it, because just the internet and social media have made all of these things so incredibly easy to do. All you need is one weak link, and humans are weak links.
You talked about the neuroscientist who was a white hat hacker. Can you just talk me through a little bit about what they were doing?
Oh, sure. So white hat hackers, they were hired by companies to hack into their systems to see, you know, where are our vulnerabilities. So they are people who actually have a legitimate job and who work to find vulnerabilities in different organizations.
Are there elements of the Con Artists Act that we could use for the greater good, or is it all just bad news?
There absolutely are. I mean, once you start looking at this, you realize how much they have in common with a lot of legitimate professions, including my own, by the way. You know, I was looking at some of these things and I said, oh my God, you know, they're journalists. They do the exact same thing. When I write, I try to tell a good story. I try to engage people emotionally. I try to affect how they think. I'm doing everything the exact same way. Obviously, I'd like to think that I'm doing it for the greater good. So I think that a lot of these tactics, they actually, you know, they can be used to motivate people to do good things, to donate to charities, to care about certain stories, to care about certain causes, to be emotionally involved with the right sorts of people. And this starts getting a little bit muddy because people start saying, well, what's the right cause? What's the right thing to do? But I think that you can see how what con artists do is motivate people to care. They just get them to care about the wrong things, the things that are better for the con artist. But we can use those exact same things to get them to care about broader issues and things that are much more important to better the human condition if we're trying to be very optimistic.
What advice can you give us on how to avoid being deceived? Are there any tips or tricks that you can point out for us so that we can try to avoid being duped?
I wish I had a 1-2-3 list for you. I can say a few things. One is that know that you're vulnerable. And never assume you're not. Even con artists can get conned and do get conned all the time. So I think there's no better proof than that of the fact that we are all possible victims. And stop thinking that you can see it coming. Don't think that you can detect lies. Just your assumption going in is, I can't spot it, because then it will actually help you in a situation, because it will make it easier for you to believe that you're being conned. The second part I would say is know your own weaknesses and know your own strengths. Know what motivates you. Do that sort of psychological analysis that a con artist is going to do on you, on yourself. Very few of us actually end up doing that. And so then you'll know when someone's trying to hit one of those buttons. By the way, something very, very practical that people can do: never accept friend requests from someone you don't know. Don't share information. You know, you should never check yourself in anywhere. We should actually be a little bit more hesitant to share things about ourselves online, in my opinion. And finally, I would say, learn to look at yourself in situations in the third person. What I mean by that is when something is happening to our neighbor, to our friend, to someone else, we are much more capable of saying, huh, I think he's getting suckered. That's just too good to be true. When something is happening to us, we lack that clarity. We say, oh, this is not too good to be true. This is perfect. This is exactly what I was expecting. And so think of yourself as your neighbor and say, okay, if this happened to my next door neighbor, what would I tell him? Would I say, hey, oh, I'm so happy for you. This looks like a great break. Or would I say, hey, are you sure? Maybe you should be a little bit more skeptical.
Sounds like good advice there. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Maria Konnikova for joining us. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the Science team, thanks for listening.
Men of Science Weekly, we've teamed up with our friends at Cornerstone to give you an offer that'll save you time, money, and give you a closer shave. With Cornerstone, you'll never have to worry about your blades being blunt again. They'll deliver their super sharp, award-winning German engineered razors right to your door. Just visit cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly, enter your initials so they can be engraved on the heavy-duty aluminium handle, and pick the delivery scheme that suits you best. And because you listen to Science Weekly, Cornerstone are giving you £10 of your first order. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Cornerstone will give you your money back with no questions asked. Head to cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly and discover an even better way to shave, starting from as little as £4. That's cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly.